Okay, let the debate begin. So this is not so much as a debate. I think we actually agree on many things. Let's see if this works. Good. And more like a contrasting of different mass ranges that can be probed with direct detection. So what I want to do is not focus on WIMPs, but focus on other ideas that are out there. And I'm going to be, it's going to be very brief, right? There's tons of ideas that are actually out there. There's a whole program going on right now at the KITP, which is going to be just a 10-week program discussing new ideas, what we should be doing. So this is really just going to be a brief introduction. So the questions that I want to ask are the following. So where else should we look? So I'll start with that. That's sort of where Jocelyn ended. And next question, can we see a signal? You're right, if we're probing a different mass range, can we actually see a signal? What are the backgrounds? That is a essential question, a crucial question, as Jocelyn already mentioned. How will we know that we found dark matter, right, if we see a signal? How low should we go in cross-section? Complementarity between direct detection and collider searches, other approaches, right? So especially if you're talking about new experiments that are probing a new mass range, should we be doing various things, or can we just do one of them, right? Save money. And should we be putting limits or projections from direct, indirect, and collider searches on the same plot? So I'll mainly actually focus on the first three questions, and then the rest will be briefer answers to that. but we can, of course, discuss afterwards. So let's start with this. Okay, so this is a plot that's been shown, I don't know, 10 times this week already. This is, Alex Kuzenko called this Tim's famous piece of work, piece of art. if you're a theorist, you're looking at this, you think to yourself, why does Tim not like me? He didn't put my model on this, right? If you're an experimentalist, you look at this and you think to yourself, these theorists are crazy. What are they doing? They don't know what they're doing, right? And I finally figured out after looking at this 10 times this week what Tim was trying to convey. So he really felt anguish about just how many models there are. And if you look closer, you can see it, and I'll help you a little bit, right? Okay, so there's really like anguish about what it could, what this really, what just how many things, possibilities there are. Okay, so hopefully I didn't ruin this picture now for you, Tim. But yeah. Okay, so where else should we look? That's the big question, right? So we have a whole mass range from 10 to minus 22 EV at the fuzzy dark matter limit, right? Below that mass range, bosonic dark matter can't form structure in conformed dwarf galaxies. Then we got all the way up to primordial black holes, you know, order 10 solar masses or so, which we'll hear about later in the talk, how viable that is. But there's really a lot of possibilities, and what do we do, right? So what we have to do, I think, is just target motivated areas, and it's also part of being practical. What can we do experimentally, and what makes sense to do from a theoretical point of view as well? And there's various answers to this, right? So I'm not going to talk about all of them, obviously. Axion, Kuzge axion, is an important target, and not as much effort has been put into that as in WIMP searches. That is, I think, an area that's very useful. It's also very hard, right? So Kuzge axion is still a viable candidate for several decades now, and that's something we should look at. But the thing I want to focus on is this mass range between a roughly a KV and 100 TV, and really, well, up to a GV, okay? Because the higher mass stuff was already discussed. And in this mass range, we have dark matter that can be in thermal equilibrium with ordinary matter. I don't actually just mean thermal equilibrium. It could also just mean thermal contact without necessarily being in thermal equilibrium, but it has some interaction with the standard model. And this means that it's sort of restricted to lie between roughly a KV, otherwise you can't form structures more than dwarf galaxies. And if you want to get the right relic abundance from thermal freeze-out, for example, it can't be really much higher than 100 TeV. Okay. So this mass range is interesting, and of course, if we find this thermal dark matter idea interesting, another reason to find it interesting is that if there's thermal contact between the dark matter and standard model, it implies some non-zero coupling between the two, which means we can probe it in a laboratory, potentially. Okay, so that makes this idea interesting and a very good experimental target, right? Now, there's many viable models that people have proposed. You know, there's asymmetric dark matter, which also suggests the GeV scale. There's SIMPs, ELDERs. Dark matter can get its abundance from Friesen, cannibal dark matter, forbidden, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So we see Tim's picture again in the back of our mind. But there's a lot of possibilities, but this is a good mass range to target. Okay? And if we have, if we look at focus on this mass range a little bit from KV to TeV, the standard WIMP direct detection searches are, very roughly speaking, above a GeV, And for this, we largely need new techniques, new experiments. And what I will argue is that, this was one of the questions, but we require complementary techniques. Direct detection alone is not going to do it. Accelerator-based searches are not going to do it. We need both. And I'll very briefly give an answer this later in the talk. And yeah, okay. So there are a lot of ideas to do this. And so Dan, myself, and Juan Estrada were working group conveners for direct detection subgroup for a workshop that was organized or requested by the Department of Energy last year. There's a ton of ideas in this paper, and we tried to give a brief overview of the ideas at the time. This is from July last year, and it's really slightly outdated because it's a fast-moving field. But if you are interested, you know, this is a place to look at. And there are really a lot of proposals, okay? So this is just sort of more for shock value rather than understanding all the curves on this. But so here's a cross-section, function of the dark matter mass. So this is the MeV scale, right? MeV to GeV. Here, this is a different kind of scenario from a KeV up to, you know, well, actually well above the GeV scale here in this case. The orange lines are actually concrete theoretical models, benchmark models. These are targets, okay? They give you a thing to aim for in parameter space in particular scenarios. The shaded regions are exclusions in this particular model setup. This is basically dark matter coupled to a dark photon with various variations of that. And the colored lines with different solid or dashing, et cetera, are proposed new direct detection ideas with various timescales. Okay? There's a lot of ideas out there. And I'm not going to cover all of them, of course, in this talk. And as a convener, I will say that all proposals were treated equally. As a private citizen, I will say that some proposals are more equal than others. But anyway. Okay. So now that we've sort of motivated very briefly this new mass range, the question is, can we actually see a signal? So this is challenging, right? As you, well, as most of you, I think, know, just because if you're having a dark matter particle scatter of nuclei in your detector, nucleus is big. And if you make the dark matter mass very small, it's very difficult to give it a lot of kinetic energy, a lot of energy, so that you can actually have a recoil that's large enough to be detectable. So it's very difficult to go well below the GeV scale. Now, there are talks by Tong Yan earlier in the conference and by Dan later today about ideas to do that. But here is the best current limit at low masses, which goes to 120 MeV from CREST last year. But the cross-section here is, you know, 10 to the 2 picobon. And the best limit from, you know, Xeon Montan sits way down there, right, at higher masses. Okay. Now, one idea to go beyond that is to have dark matter scatter of electrons. And with this, you can probe well below the GeV scale. And I want to focus on this idea because it's really getting, you know, real experiments are coming online now and being done to really look for this, as I'll try very briefly review. So the idea now is instead of hitting a big nucleus, you hit a electron inside the atoms, okay? Now the electron is much lighter, so it's much easier to give it a decent amount of energy that you could potentially see, okay? And the signal that you're looking for, right, is that you maybe have an atom, a xenon atom, which you ionize. The electron, you ionize the atom, so you have an electron. And you give that electron a bit of kinetic energy, it might ionize a few other atoms if it has enough kinetic energy. So you might see a signal of 1, 2, 3, 4 electrons. Now, you can also do this in semiconductors, in silicon or germanium, where you take an electron that's in the valence band of a semiconductor, hit it, excite the conduction band, and then you can measure that charge in principle. Okay. And again, you produce one or a few electrons depending on how much kinetic energy you give this electron to begin with. And there's demonstrated sensitivity with noble liquid detectors and silicon detectors. Now, just to show that, the best limits right now, down to few MeV in masses, come from, well, the best limit on the lowest masses from dark matter scattering of electrons comes from xenon 10, which ran, you know, more than 10 years ago. Okay, so this goes down to few MeV. They had sensitivity to single electrons, and Elena and Atok may explain why that is. They see single electrons. All these time prediction chambers, these experiments in general, are able to see single electrons. Xenon 100 sets a very similar limit, doesn't go quite as low, just because of the available data. And then Darkside 50, very recently, you know, 2 months ago in February, they also put out a paper where they also set a limit on this. Now, look at the exposures. Xenon 10 is, you know, 0.04 kilogram years. Dark side 50 was 19 kilogram years, and xenon 100 was 30 kilogram years. And the limits didn't change much. That tells you there's a huge background, right, which is not yet fully understood. So there's a large detector-specific background. It's really the way these things operate. The problem is not that they can't see single electrons. The problem is they see way too many. Okay. And there's various things, various reasons for that, which we can go into in the discussion session, of why that background might be. So there's R&D ongoing, right? There's also an effort called LBECA, which stands for Low Background Electron Counting Apparatus, with ideas to build sort of an order kilogram, 10 kilogram xenon detector. And one of the proponents of that, Kai Chuan Yi, is an audience, so you can ask him about that. Okay? So there might be good prospects for making progress on this. But right now, you know, this is limiting the discovery potential and the sensitivity. So one other, another experiment that I want to mention, and this is actually not going to be discussed at the conference, so I wanted to spend 3 minutes on this. This is an effort called Sensei, which uses CCDs, silicon CCDs. So here's a picture of a CCD, has about order million pixels. And the idea is that the dark matter would come in, hit an electron in one of these pixels in the silicon in the CCD, excite the electron from the valence band to the conduction band, and then produce a few electrons in one of the pixels. Then the pixels get moved to the side and to one of the corners where they're read out. Okay, you measure the charge. And one of the nice things is that this experiment uses something called skipper CCDs, which is a special kind of CCD where the readout is special, where you can actually sample the same pixel 1,000 times and make the same measurement 1,000 times of the charge non-destructively. And that averages down the noise a lot, and basically you have sub-electron noise precision. Okay, so you can actually count the charge in a pixel precisely. You know if it's 0, 1, 2, 3, 1,000, 1,500, etc. Okay. So this was demonstrated last year. this is really the first dedicated experiment that's searching for electron recalls from sub-GB dark matter. Okay, so it's basically funded. It is funded by the Heising Science Foundation and Fermilab, and it is designed to do electron recalls. Okay. And the goal is to use about 100 grams of these skipper CCDs to do a very sensitive search for dark matter. Now, right now, a month ago, beginning of April, we had our first result out from Sensei. So here's the combined xeno-10, xeno-100, dark side 50 limit. And this is the limit from Sensei, which is the first time you're getting to probe down to 500 kV. This is a prototype skipper CCD, so it's not a great quality CCD. Better ones are being procured. This is only 0.019 gram days. So compared to 15 kilogram days for xenon-10 or the 30 kilogram years for xenon-100, for example. Good. So the projections for Sensei are the following. So you've got the ultimate goal is to have a 100-gram experiment running for 1 year, and here's a particular model scenario. And you can really see that this is not incremental progress, right? This is a massive amount of progress. And the point of this is if this experiment works and one can run it, right? The point of this is that this mass range is so unexplored that the constraints are so weak in this mass range that even having a tiny experiment can do enormous amount of stuff, okay? And in principle, right, if you're sitting here, the dark matter model sits here, which is allowed in principle, you could see a million events in your detector after running for 1 year. Okay. Now, SuperCMS also had a very nice constraint earlier this week, where they also looked at electron recoils, and they also have sensitivity to distinguish 1, 2, 3 electrons from each other. They can also do a very sensitive dark matter search. And Jody, I hope, will cover this a little bit in her talk, so I won't discuss exactly how this works, but this is a different technology, which is great. Okay, and they also go down to a few hundred kV and below the xenon-10 limit. Okay, so big question, what are the backgrounds? So that is a very important question, right? Jocelyn was saying we need background discrimination. Okay. Too quick, okay. So what are the backgrounds? Radioactivity is certainly an obvious one that you think about, and experimenters work very hard to get that down. Another background is solar neutrinos. And then one important one is dart counts. And I'll explain each of these means in a minute. And I'll just mention that, you know, depending on the type of dark matter search you're doing and the type of experimental setup, there's other critical backgrounds potentially. So vibrations, electronic noise, coherent photon scattering if you go below an MeV masses. So there's a lot of things you have to worry about. Now, radioactivity is actually a background that is not a problem, or expected to be a problem, for the first generation experiments. So here's a background expectation for Sensei, which is much looser than Super CDMS hopes to achieve at Snow Lab. And it's based on just repeating what people have done with DAMIC. So here's an example of number of events for a particular dark matter electron scattering cross section, doesn't matter what it is. And here's the number of electron hole pairs that get created. So you see the dark matter signal has the shape for taking a 10 MeV dark matter mass here. And the background from Compton's, which we believe is the most important thing, is pretty flat and sits about 1.1 events in 100 gram year exposure, you know, in each of these bins. And you can clearly see, you know, a big dark matter signal sticking out, and this is a viable model. Okay, so basically, you expect less than one event per kilogram per year per EV, based on known ways to shield, purify, and handle materials. It's not inventing new things. It's basically using the amazing work that experimenters have done over the last, you know, 2-3 decades in getting to these low background levels. And of course, for larger exposures, you will see some backgrounds. You've got to either prove your shielding or, you know, the materials or the handling of the materials. But of course, as you can see, the shape is very different, right? If you're looking for this, it's different from looking for a flat background. And the reason they're flat, right, these Compton backgrounds, is that the dominant energy of radioactive decays or so actually sits at multi-KV, in the multi-KV energy range. And what you have is a low energy tail, but it's just a tail. The dominant thing sits in the mass range where you would look for WIMPs, which is why background discrimination is absolutely essential for WIMP searches, especially given the amazing sensitivity that they're achieving, have achieved already. But for a first generation experiment, you don't need the same requirements. Okay. You can do a lot without too much effort, in quotes. So another possible background is total neutrinos. So there's two possibilities, right? So we're looking for electron recoils. We're not looking for nuclear recoils. So one possibility is that solar neutrinos can scatter up electrons to give you signal. It turns out that in the mass range, in the energy range of interest that we're looking for the dark matter signal, that's completely negligible. There is another possibility is that the dark matter that the neutrino scatters off the nucleus recoils and gives a small amount of ionization, which will then mimic the dark matter signal. And that, of course, depends on the ionization efficiency, which is unknown, but one can vary over this. One can, you know, make reasonable assumptions about what it does at low energies. And what you get is the following, very roughly. So this is work that was done mostly by my student, Mukul, at Stony Brook. And so here's the xenon 10 and xenon 100 limits. This is in silicon. And here are the solid lines. Let's ignore the bands for a second. Let's just look at the solid lines. Here's the reach for 100 gram year, kilogram year, 10, 100, and 1,000 kilogram year. The solid lines are including the neutrino background. If we were to ignore the neutrino background, if we assume we just had a perfect background-free search, then we would get the dashed lines. So you see that the dashed lines are basically overlapping with the solid for the 100 gram, the kilogram year exposures. But as we get to 10, 100, and 1,000, we see the two lines start diverging, and neutrinos are becoming a bigger and bigger problem. So you can see that, at least for silicon, the neutrinos begin limiting the sensitivity for a few kilogram year exposures and above. But again, you can do a first generation experiment, order kilogram year, without a problem, without worrying about neutrino backgrounds. So for xenon, it's actually not quite the same. So for xenon, if you are sensitive to single electrons, right, without any other backgrounds, in that case, you actually run into neutrinos much sooner. One reason for that is that the xenon is a higher Z nucleus, so the neutrino scattering cross section is just larger. There's also another reason, which I won't go into, but that's one big reason. So, and what you can see is that already for 100 gram years, the solid line and the dashed lines start diverging. So you already have to start worrying about neutrinos. Said another way, you will see solar neutrinos, even a 100 gram year detector. Okay. And of course, it gets bigger and bigger divergence as you go lower. So for xenon, you will have to start worrying about neutrinos for order 100 gram years already. And the bands that I didn't mention before, that's basically trying to vary over the ionization efficiency uncertainty at low energies. All right, good. So then the third background that I'll discuss, which is, that is the most important one, dark counts. Now, what are dark counts? So really, dark counts, what I mean here are, is a very general catch-all phrase for detector-specific backgrounds that mimic the dark matter signal. And that can be various things. So one option is that they're impurities. They could be leakage currents. They could be thermal fluctuations, which just randomly give you the same signal. Okay. So clearly, there is a serious background challenge for many proposals because you're looking for such small signals that anything that can potentially mimic this is, of course, a problem. And the reason often is because you're trying to tease out a small signal, which means you need to, often you need to amplify the signal. And when you try to amplify it, you amplify all kinds of other things as well, potentially. So in xenon, this is a problem. You have, you know, sensitivity is currently limited by what you might call dark counts. This comes from impurities, trapping of the liquid gas interface, and other things which we can discuss, or which Eleanor might discuss later. For Sensei, we have thermal fluctuations, which, so the detector sits at about 100 Kelvin, a bit higher, 130 Kelvin or so. So you can just excite electrons from the valence matter conduction band just from thermal fluctuations. And assuming the silicon is good enough, you're still going to get tons of single electron events, but the hope is that you will not get two electron events, okay, or very rarely. But this needs to be demonstrated. So that's the hope, that we can have a threshold of at least two electrons that's background-free, and background-free from these particular thermal fluctuations, from these particular dark counts. In super-CDMS, there's charge leakage, so they also bias the detector to try and accelerate any electrons that come out to give you a phonon signal, and that can also lead to just, it can also just ionize impurities, which will then give you a signal. And that currently limits the threshold. And of course, there is unknown dark counts, which is the big worry, right? What do we do with if we see a signal, and you know, how do we really characterize it and understand it? Okay, so that's the main stuff I want to talk about. Then in the last few minutes, I want to quickly go through the other questions. So how will we know that we found dark matter? So we don't have background discrimination for the subject of dark matter searches looking for electron recoils. We just don't. Our signal is an electron recoil. For WIMP searches, we have electron recoils that are the background, and we're looking for nuclear recoils. You need background discrimination there, and you have a, you know, you just look for two different types of signal. Here, the dominant background from the thing that's the background for WIMP search is also the signal here, right? We're looking for electron recoils. So now there are actually several handles that exist to understand if you were to see an excess. I think that, you know, there's still the animal modulation signal. It is a good signal to look for, despite the Dharma saga for 20 years. It is a very strong indication of where the dark matter might be there. But you have to do the experiment at different places, maybe in the southern hemisphere and the northern hemisphere, to make sure that it's not some temperature-dependent or season-dependent effect that you're missing. Other experiments have to produce it, of course. The signal shape is very different between the dark matter signal and the backgrounds, okay? That's a strong handle. There's also temperature dependence. So for example, for Sensei, the dark counts should be dependent on temperature. So if we increase the temperature, we should see more dark counts. If we decrease it, we should see less. That can be checked. Now, having said all this, I think that, you know, having a single experiment claim a discovery is going to be very, very hard in this field. And it's unlikely you're going to be convincing to the community in general. I think that one would need to check it with another detective technology, another collaboration, independent people, and really try to see whether it persists, any particular excess. You also might want to look for both electron and nuclear couplings. So we should be supporting efforts that look for both types of signals. That'll, you know, help narrow down also the possibility of what kind of dark matter it might be, what kind of dark matter particle might be. You can try to probe it with accelerators, right? So that depends on exactly what type of model it is. But accelerator-based searches like beam dumps, which we'll hear about later at the conference as well, they can probe often same kind of models. So I'm optimistic, but I think it'll be likely to be a long road. It won't just be a single thing, that a single experiment that will claim discovery, or should claim discovery. Okay, so how low should we go in cross sections? So then I'm going to be very brief. My answer is keep going, you know, at least until the solar industry knows begin to limit severely your reach, and it becomes just so expensive to make progress. There's models that sit at very low cross sections. So you just, I think, you know, there's maybe a glib answer, but I think you just keep going. Complementarity between direct detection and collider searches. So let me talk a bit about this. So the answer is that you need both direct detection and accelerator-based searches. So here's simple examples that try to explain this. So if you have a dark matter particle that is mediated with some mediator, like a dark photon, that mediates the actions between the dark matter and standard matter particles, and there's some typical momentum transfer, which for dark matter scattering of electrons in your detector is a few kV. If you have a mediator that's larger than that momentum transfer, it turns out that both direct detection and accelerators are great. So I'm not going to explain that in more detail, but both can probe the same kind of models. If you have a mediator instead that's much, much lighter than the typical momentum transfer, then this cross-section for dark matter scattered electrons in your detector scales as one of the momentum transfer to the fourth power. So then if you have a low threshold detector, you get a very tiny Q, and you get a very large cross-section. Whereas at accelerators, you know, you have relativistic particles that you're colliding, you have a large Q, and you're just going to have a small cross-section. So in this case, direct detection experiments are much better. And then finally, if you, for example, have inelastic dark matter, where the dark matter particle couples to the mediator, but there's two states for the dark matter that are slightly split in mass, so I'm naming them chi1, chi2. So chi1 is the actual dark matter particle, but there might be a partner state that's slightly heavier. And it might be that the kinetic energy of the dark matter, half mv squared in the halo, just is not large enough compared to the mass difference, smaller than the mass difference between these two particles. Then it just cannot scatter in your direct detection experiments. But accelerators don't care. They have relativistic particles. You just collide them, and you can produce both of these particles. So in this case, accelerators are much, much better. Okay. So we need both, depending on what the model is. In an ideal scenario, you have models where you can actually have overlap, where both could actually see something, and that would be very nice. It would be very convincing. So then the question is, you know, so next final question is, should we put limits, projections from direct, indirect, and collider searches on the same plot? The answer is no. So you can if you must, but you have to make sure that you really specify the model that you're talking about. It is very model dependent. You can have models which show up in one, but not the others. I mean, that's the case for all of them. And it also applies for WIMP searches. So it's really a very model dependent question. And if you just don't want to bother with getting emails, nasty emails, you just don't do it. Okay.
Thermodynamic is the models in there, it's in small.
Yeah. Okay, so to summarize, here's the questions and then just quick answers. Where else should we look? So subject dark matter, I think, is well motivated and ripe for experimental exploration. I'll try to explain that a little bit today. There's modest R&D funding for developing new ideas, which I think is essential. There's a ton of ideas out there. It's really great, and there's a lot of activity, but it does need to be followed up with support, financial support. And I think it's an important thing if we want to find dark matter. Until we found it, you know, then we can stop, of course, but we don't know when that will be, if that will be. Can we see a signal? So for electron recalls in particular, the answer is yes. In some cases, it's very easy to see a signal. In the xenons, there's too much signal. There's too many detector-specific backgrounds. What are the backgrounds? So very important, right? So I think for first-generation searches, less than a kilogram, well, maybe 100 gram or so, radioactivity is under control, right? Given the huge effort that was already invested by experimentalists over the last two decades or so. Neutrinos are not important for the low exposure searches, but they will become more important as we go up in exposures. And you need various handles on dark counts. That's really crucial, and that's going to be, if anyone ever reports a signal, that's what the questions will be about. Do you understand strange, rare events if you do a 100 gram year experiment or a kilogram year experiment? How will we know that we found dark matter? So I'm optimistic, but I think it'll be a long road. How low should we go in cross-section? So I think we should just keep going in principle. I think it's more limited not by physics, but by financial considerations. And certainly I think, eventually you'll be limited by neutrinos where it's just much harder to make progress, or at least we need new ideas to make progress. Complementarity between direct and collider searches, I think both are essential, and input limits predation in the same plot, not in general, but if you must, just specify precisely what your model is. Thank you.
Let's see, first questions to Ruben only, and then we can proceed to the discussion. Dan.
So I wanted to push a bit, or pick at this idea that in the ER searches, you don't have discrimination. And I mean, you can certainly imagine, I don't have a dog in this particular race, but you can certainly imagine that you have experiments that measure both heat and charge or heat and light and get discrimination power in the ER channel as a result. And you know, usually in the history of the field, usually you know, you have a technology, you run for a while, you run into a background, and then you have to figure out a more clever technology to get past those backgrounds, and it keeps on going. And those more clever backgrounds have more signal channels. Now, I don't know what these charge-only signals experiments you're going to run into. But I would bet that it won't be too long before you wish you had another channel.
So I think...
electron recoil signal.
I think if you're looking for electron recoil, so that channel would be useful if you had nuclear recoil backgrounds, right?
But if you your dark counts, whatever they are, will look different from your electron recoil signal if you have two channels or more to work with.
An electron is an electron, right? So it depends where it comes from, maybe.
Well, there are two electrons or three or four.
Right.
And they will also make heat. You will also get heat
yeah,
loss.
I see.
You can
yeah.
measure that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, so maybe. So it depends what comes
so
from.
So I'll make a bold prediction that before long you wish you had some heat signal.
Yeah. No, so that's... Yeah, so it's maybe super CDMS can do that.
I think it depends on the technology that's measuring them. So like in super CDMS, the way that we are detecting them right now is the phonons are quantized. So you're seeing a peak around a single phonon, or a single electron, you're seeing a peak in the phonon distribution around single electrons, and then one around two electrons, and then three, and then four. Right. So the phonons...
I wish you had that prompt peak and the charge.
I think we probably wish that we already did, but that's sort of where we are right now.
Yeah, yeah. Not first generation, but yes, good. So let's sense we can find an excess, and then we can...
Okay. So I guess we'll learn more in Jody's talk about this. Yeah. Okay, more questions? Wait, Kaishuan.
So as Ruben said, this right now, the background is really dominated by dark counts. That's why xenon 10, xenon 100, and lux cannot go beyond the current limit.
Right?
xenon 10 will be even better. So I think we still have a lot of things to work on these dark counts, right? We can eliminate them instead of looking for another channel. I think that's more challenging for the next generation.
You want to chew gum and walk at the same time. You don't have to choose. You want to push on lowering your backgrounds, and you want to push on having more channels than just one.
I guess everybody agrees that we'd like to have more than one channel, definitely. So, and with time, people also get new ideas and clever. So, Elena.
Very briefly, I think it's right that it's actually quite around the corner because we know that a lot of the energy goes in the infrared, for instance, another wavelength, we just keep stuck. Change is difficult, but for noble liquids, it's a message to Kaishuan. Putting another channel should be relatively simple because we just have to use some different light sensors. Let's say infrared comes to mind because we know a lot of the heat goes in there. So we just have to depart from the status quo and do it.
Yeah, I fully agree, and there are people who want to start at least looking, as Elena says, for liquid xenon also into the infrared signal, not only at the VUV, vacuum ultraviolet, where we have the main signal. Write it down. More questions?
May I ask a kind of broad question coming from a completely different angle here? I mean, how much of do you think we need in the sense of changing the way the community operates on these things? Like, I have this idea that what you see as background, as noise, and there's actually a lot of physics in it. And to me, it seems like, you know, there is an opportunity missed by not digging into, you know, what physics are we learning as we go along and as we reject or learn from all these backgrounds and things. So perhaps, you know, the lesson from astronomy is that you build a telescope to find something, but in the end, it's more interesting with the other things you find. So your noise ends up being your data in some sense. So perhaps, you know, designing dark matter experiments that are meant to find dark matter, but at the same time promise new physics, is that a good way to think about it? Like, for example, neutrino background, eventually you'll get there, it seems, but is there a richness there in the signal that identifying, you know, what neutrinos are actually doing? What are your thoughts on this?
So, yeah, so you could potentially learn more about solar neutrinos, right? And I think there's a lot known. So it may be challenging without going to really large masses to learn something. Come, Jocelyn.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is and now for both, right? So
yeah,
maybe open the discussion.
Yeah, I really agree with that perspective. I think, you know, dark matter experiments up to this point have been small enough that, you know, even to say something statistically significant about the background in some cases has been difficult. But now I think we're at the scale where, you know, the background is interesting, right? Direct detection experiments are starting to look at pseudoscalars using electron channels, and I think maybe there's something we can do with looking at actually measuring the background precisely. I think this is a really important point. And, you know, my feeling is we, for a long time, have thought about direct detection experiments as being one measurement experiments, right? You make your one measurement, and then you go on and build the next one. And I think it's a very interesting thing to think about building the next experiment as, you know, being a little bit more like a SNOW or a Super K, right? Where if you can build something that has, you know, target mass with very low threshold, you can do a lot of interesting physics. You know, if you look at the range of papers that came out of SNOW, you know, there's all kinds of stuff, right? There's like frequency burst searches in astrophysics, there's all kinds of strange, you know, NN bar oscillation physics. You know, there are a lot of things beyond the measurement that SNOW is known for that you can do when it's at that scale. I think this is a very pertinent point.
I mean, I would also say that we already do that. I mean, we are thinking about that, right? We discussed neutrinos double beta decay with xenon detectors, actually LZ, also xenon Anton. We are changing the electronics and so on to have a better sensitivity. So there are many, many, you know, especially neutrino channels, but other stuff that we are already considering. So.
Yeah, but both you and Jocelyn are speaking like, this is the prerequisite of a SNOW. I mean, it's happening only now. The first thing you have to prove is to keep this detector stable for years and years. We just barely did with Xeno-1 Town for a year, more than a year, we're still running. But this has been one of the, we first have to demonstrate that the technology are still much more complex than, let's say, the experiments you mentioned, the typical neutrino experiment, despite how beautiful they are. They're much simpler in technologies to keep for tens of years. So, I mean, I'm more skeptical. I'm more practical. But we're getting there.
We agree. I mean, we agree. It took you know, more than a decade to develop. So I think, you know, 20 years ago, we were the new kids on the block with the WIMP searches. So we were now it's, of course, the low mass WIMP. But it took like more than one decade to develop, you know, these technologies and to be where we are with the backgrounds and with the thresholds, right? So that we can start doing all of this stuff, you know, and the low mass searches will get there as well, right? But
I think we've had impacts on other fields too. For example, in the search to find materials to build our detectors out of, we've certainly pressed the limits of what technologies for screening and assay can do. I think the chemists at PNNL, and I'm sure in Europe at Grand Sasso and stuff, who do things like ICP-MS, have done to their instruments in order to figure out how you can assay things at the sub-pico, you know, Becquerel level in order to get wherever it is that we need to get these materials. I know at PNNL we're constantly, you know, pushing the limits, and you can even look at the papers that go into publications like NIM, etc., on the techniques to do assay. alone are, you know, which are fields that are not what we're doing in astrophysics, maybe, or even particle physics, but are on other fields. You know, there's an impact there as well.
Okay, Sean.
So I just follow Elena. She's always practical. And but, you know, just remind, 10 years ago, we had 10 kilogram detector. You proposed a one-ton detector, and now it's working, right? So we're just at the beginning of this one-ton scale detector. But I think it's not very ambitious, you know, to propose a 100-ton detector to run in 10 years. Right? It's another two orders magnitude. I think that we are there. I'm proud.
Kaishwan, you have to make a third plot to go on that slide.
No, but what Kaishwan missed on that plot, and we have some of the, he was the first student and Dan was around, but I was in a one ton then. We didn't dare, I didn't dare. It was made of 10 modules of the 100 kilograms. So, you know, the technology has matured a lot, and I can see that we can keep this detector. It's thanks to what Judy also said, not only how we build them, but also in terms of the apparatus that we need, the cryogenics, for instance, purifications. We have learned a lot in these last 10, 15 years, but to scale up, in my opinion, in my own mind, from this scale to the next, it's a step that at least I personally cannot see, but I mean, one has to be optimistic. You're younger, so keep dreaming, but I keep being grounded on the floor, actually. I'm only, if I can keep the microphone, one of my, what you said is the first proof that we could, how do you say, the first way that we can convince ourselves that we have seen something real is that we see it in a different target, right? We all agree that this multitude of targets are needed, and my worry is, so one other question is, okay, so in fact, I'm very curious to know how would we feel if we would see something. It's wonderful on the Xenon camp for sure, as I will show, right? We have this rays right now. It's great. It's actually useful because we have two, maybe three independent collaboration using the same technology, but that's actually a strength because if somebody sees and you see two, I mean, it's wonderful. On the other end, it would be even more wonderful if we will see it in liquid argon, for instance, which is the next, or in germanium. And so there, I'm wondering, you are really so optimistic that we can see at is the time scale, you, as you are involved, compatible? I mean, do you see that we can have this beautiful scenario where we have something, at least in two targets, that we can have two targets running in similar time scale with similar sensitivity?
If similar has a, you know, band which is 5 years wide, then I think yes. That would be my guess. I mean, I think to kind of come back to the point about the same target, I think this is actually very important, right? I didn't sort of say anything about Cogent and Malbec. But I think this is another historical example that we, you know, can learn from, right? So the right thing was done there, right? Cogent had some anomaly. Malbec, another detector of the same kind, was operated with, you know, a slightly different readout so that there was more information. And in fact, the signal was identified to go away. And I think, you know, that process is also extremely important. So I think, you know, you learn something from having multiple instances of the same technology to test something. I think that's quite a relevant point. The other thing I would say about Malbec and Cogent was that this supports the sort of same case about requiring additional information on background discrimination to study in excess. You know, but I think, so to come to the question about argon, I mean, I think it's plausible that, so, you know, thinking specifically about the case of DarkSide 20K. So DarkSide 20K will use a new photosensor. I think that the production of the photosensor and the testing at large scale will happen within the next 2 years. And this is really critical. And if this is successful, then I think it is possible that there will be a large scale argon experiment that operates on a similar time scale with similar reach. I think, you know, this is a new technology development and the results so far are very impressive, but again, they're from, you know, a very small number of prototypes. So I think we will learn a lot in the next 18 months, really, about whether this can happen on a comparable time scale. But even if there's another round of iteration on the photosensor technology, I think it's possible that within the next that on a time scale which is compatible within, say, 5 years, that there would be, this test. Because I will say, detectors at the scale of 3.5 tons have now been operating stably for, 18 months. We have some, we're building up some experience with argon with the long-term stable operations. And the kind of, I think the big jump in my mind at the next scale is the change of the photosensor technology.
But it's quite different technology, though.
Yes, very. Exactly. Very. Yes, it's a big step.
So I was going to fly up to 30,000 feet for a second. I don't know if that's okay. But because I often think, I think we probably, everyone in this room, although I maybe not, agree that, do all of the above, right? Look everywhere that you can, okay? And, of course, we all know we're in the real world and we can't, money doesn't grow on trees, et cetera. But, of course, from that perspective, if I, all the crazy work I've done in reviewing and in agencies and stuff, I would say we've done remarkably well for not having a signal to scale up as much as we have. And come on. It does bother me in the DOE because I've been a creature of the DOE since I became a graduate student. You can look around, and I can't even keep track of how many liquid argon neutrino experiments there are. I just refer to it all as the liquid argon neutrino industrial complex. Just a vast, vast stuff of, and why they have a signal, okay? And it's a surprisingly strong program, but anyway. And you could say similar things about the energy frontier. They have some signals. They don't have the signal they want at the moment, but they have a lot of signals. So I think we've done really well. One small comment with respect to that, we because we don't have a signal, we have all sorts of institutional difficulties. We fall between cracks of all sorts. I could write an essay on that. But for example, even in the liquid argon community, some people want to do double beta decay. And it's, if I were a congressman, I'd look at this, I'd look at a double beta decay liquid argon experiment, look at a dark matter one, and I'd say, what the hell? Why do you need two of these? Okay. And with xenon, sorry, I meant xenon, liquid xenon, okay. And of course, one of the great things for testing a signal is to change isotopic composition of a xenon experiment, which is really important, actually. Okay, that was a small comment to you. It doesn't really matter, okay. We have these institutional issues, and sometimes I have the following thought, that our problem is we're terrible, dismal, grade F con artists. We're just not good at being con artists, okay? Because, first of all, if we were good con artists, our first move with DAMO would have been always to say, brilliant, great experiment. It's a signal. Because without a signal, we can't grow. You need a signal to grow, okay? I've always felt very warm towards DAMO. I don't know what. And I know there's all sorts of problems. I've been around. I know the problems. But other real con artists would have never been as honest as us, okay? We were way too honest, and we're way too honest in general, okay? To scale up, maybe I'm the only one that has André Druquier come to my office periodically. Am I the only one who, none of you have André Druquier knock on your door? Yeah, okay, you throw him out. Yeah, you have, well, now he wants to be a con artist. You must agree with me that that's his goal in life, is to be a con artist. And he's a lot of fun to have in your office if he comes.
I ran into him in Stockholm, in the street.
Good God.
And he said, you ruined my life.
He said that to me too, okay.
Why? He said, because you don't want to think that it's that matter and it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, in any case, so my to sum up, I know I've gone on for a while, but I did say I was going up to 30,000 feet. We have to always be positive about the whole endeavor, right? When we snipe, we just make it easy for all the people who programmatically don't want to support dark matter, don't have to support dark matter. We make it easier for them to check out of the problem. Okay, we can't do that. All right, we have to be sort of uniformly positive about everybody else, even André.
Positivism.
Yeah, and the second thing is as I've tried for the last 10 or 20 years to do this stuff, these people going to the Simons Foundation, that's probably the best move in the United States at this point. And what we really ought to be looking at is you know, a group of us helping the Simons Foundation. That would probably be our best move. Our agencies in the U.S., I don't know when they're going to, I don't know when it's all going to get good again, if it ever will. No, anyway.
Thank you for letting me
Can I respond to one part of that? There was part of that really resonated with me coming, you know, being based in the UK and thinking about this upcoming CERN strategy process, which is that historically our community, particle astrophysics, hasn't in Europe been coupled strongly to CERN. And I think that as we think about getting bigger, you know, maybe we need to couple into that more. You know, there's not a, there, you know, in the same way at the energy frontier that there's like a lab that backs that program, where when you have a new idea about detector development, there's some engineering and technical resource that's on board to go for it and kind of help things along at the beginning. I don't know that that exists in the same way for our field, for particle astrophysics. And I think as we're getting to the next scale, that we should plug into that more. You know, I think in Europe, at least, it's important that the direct detection community not say, oh, the European strategy, that's for CERN and high energy physics. I think we should think about whether there are ways that, you know, we're asking some of the same questions. Are there ways that, you know, CERN can support, you know, our physics program more substantially? Because I think that would help us a lot, right? If I come back to this example about the liquid argon neutrino industrial complex, the investment of CERN in the neutrino platform, which is a small fraction of that total program, absolutely catalyzed a huge amount. Right? And so, you know, it's not necessarily that the lab took a majority in financing, but the lab involvement catalyzed a huge amount globally. And I think that that's maybe a lesson that we should learn.
Well, yeah, so I would.
Their two-phase component is related to dark matter. I mean, and I always look at that as somebody who's, whoever it is, I mean, again, good con artists are going to play that boundary.
That was actually the reverse. That was.
So I would disagree with this whole con artist bit. I think having a reputation actually counts for something. Some integrity actually helps. But okay, putting that aside, I agree with you. As these experiments get bigger and bigger and the funding level starts rising to these accelerator levels, some sort of interplay is necessary. There's a couple of comments I want to make. One is, there is at CERN this Physics Beyond Colliders project or study. And so that's an interesting thing. It includes all sorts of stuff, but.
But if I can make a quick response, it explicitly does not include direct detection.
Okay, but.
I get told that by Claude Vallée.
Okay.
Yeah, I know.
And then the second thing, though, is that in addition to accommodating these larger and larger projects, another really essential thing is to be lighter on our feet for the small projects. And, you know, P5 in the U.S., which I was involved with, and other people in the room, you know, we set aside a little bucket of small project funds, which seems to have been eaten away and disappeared. But that was a good idea. And talking about all these things that Ruben's talking about, somehow getting that across to agencies, speaking as a community, that there are a bunch of small projects that can be done quickly, can be done cheaply, can be done with small collaborations that are not hundreds of people. That needs to get across also.
Thank you. So any other urgent question, comment? Well, if not, let's thank the speakers again and everybody for the discussion. Thank you. And then we reconvene at 11.